of telling it. And what was that but plausibility? His mind continued to go round and round the thing. In the man's favour, there he was again, was the fact that the fingerprints on the revolver and those on the letter containing the money were the same. If the prints he had sent from Carninish proved to be the same as these, then the man's story was true to that extent. The tale of Sorrel's letters from a feminine source could be checked by application to Mrs. Everett. Mrs. Everett evidently believed Lamont innocent, and had gone to considerable lengths in support of her conviction, but then she was prejudiced, and therefore not a competent judge. Supposing, then, that the man's tale was a concocted one, what combination of circumstances would explain his murdering Sorrel? Was it possible that he had resented his friend's departure without offering to help him so much that he could commit murder for it? But he had Sorrel's money in his possession. If he had obtained that money before Sorrel died, he would have no reason for killing him. And if he had not, then the money would have been found in Sorrel's possession. Or suppose he had obtained the money by stealing his friend's pocketbook during that afternoon. He would still have no urge to murder, and there would have been every reason to keep away from the queue. The more Grant thought of it, the more impossible it became to invent a really good theory as to why Lamont should have murdered Sorrel. Most of all in his favour was that he should have come to so public a place as a theatre queue to expostulate with his friend about something. It was not a usual preliminary to intended murder. But perhaps the murder had not been intended. Lamont did not give the impression of a man who would intend murder for very long at a time. Had the quarrel been not over the revolver at all, but about something more bitter? Was there a woman in the case after all, for instance? For no reason, Grant had a momentary recollection of Lamont's face when the Dinmont girl had gone out of the room as if he was not there, and the tones of his voice when he was telling of Sorrel's suspected romance, and he dismissed that theory. But about business. Lamont had evidently felt his comparative poverty very keenly, and had resented his friend's lack of sympathy. Was his fed-up a euphemism for a smouldering resentment that had blazed into hatred? But, after having had £223... No, of course, he didn't know about that until afterwards. That might have been true, that tale of the packet, and he had taken it for granted that it contained the expected watch. After all, one does not expect to be handed £223 by a departing friend, whose whole fortune it is. That was possible to the point of probability. He had said goodbye, and afterwards— But what did he argue about? If he had come back to stab Sorrel, he would not have called attention to himself. And what had Sorrel intended to do? If Lamont's story were true, then the only explanation of Sorrel's conduct was intended suicide. The more Grant thought, the more certain he became that only light on Sorrel's history would elucidate the problem and prove Lamont's guilt or, incredible, innocence. His first business when he was back in town would be to do what he had neglected in his hurry to get Lamont, find Sorrel's luggage and go through it. And if that yielded nothing, he would see Mrs. Everett again. He would like to meet Mrs. Everett once more. He took a last look at the calmly sleeping Lamont and said a last word to the stolidly wakeful constable and composed himself to sleep, worried but filled with resolution. This business was not going to be left where it was. Chapter 15. The Brooch. After a hot bath, during which he had twiddled his toes in the wavering steam and tried to mesmerize himself into that habitually comfortable frame of mind of a detective officer who has got his man, Grant repaired to the yard and went to interview his chief. When he came into the great man's presence, Barker was complimentary. "Congratulations, Grant," he said. "That was very smart work altogether," and he asked for details of the capture, which Grant had not, of course, included in his official report, and Grant provided him with a vivid sketch of the 3 days at Carnanish. The superintendent was highly amused.
"Well done," he said. "Rather you than me. Careering across bogs was never a sport of mine. It seems you were the right man in the right place this time, Grant."
"Yes," said Grant, unenthusiastically.
"You don't let your emotions run away with you, do you?"
said Barker, grinning at his unsmiling face. "Well, it's been luck, mostly, and I made one bad break."
"What was that?"
"I found out that Sorrel had really intended to go to America, at least that he had booked a berth, and I forgot that his belongings would be lying at a terminus waiting to be examined."
"That doesn't sound a very vital mistake to me. You know who the man was and who his friends were. What more could you find out that would help you to Lamont?"
"Nothing about Lamont. It was because I was so hard on Lamont's trail that I forgot about the luggage. But I want to know more about Sorrel. To tell you the truth," he added in a sudden burst, "I'm not very happy about this case." Barker's jaw dropped just a little.
"What's wrong?"
he said.
"It's the clearest case the Yard has had for some time."
"Yes, on the surface. But if you dig a bit, there seems to be more than meets the eye."
"What do you mean? That there was more than one in it?"
"No, I mean that there's just the barest possibility that we've got the wrong one." For a little there was silence.
"Grant," said Barker at last, "I never knew you lose your nerve before. You need a holiday. I don't think scooting across moors can be good for you. Perhaps the jogging movement is addling to the brain. You certainly have lost your critical faculty."
Grant could find nothing to say except, "Well, here's the statement he gave us last night," and he handed it over. While Barker was reading it, he crossed to the window, gazed at the patch of green and the river in the sun, and wondered if he were making a complete fool of himself to be worrying when he had a good case. Well, fool or no fool, he would go along to Waterloo as soon as his chief had finished with him, and see what he could pick up there. When Barker dropped the statement with a little flop onto the table, Grant turned eagerly to see what effect it had on him.
"Well," said that worthy, "it leaves me with a strong desire to meet Mr. Lamont."
"Why?" asked Grant.
"Because I'd like to see in person the man who tried sob stuff on Inspector Grant and got away with it.
The unimpressionable Grant."
"That's how it strikes you, is it?"
Grant said gloomily. "You don't believe a word of it?"
"Not a word," said Barker cheerfully. "It's about the thinnest story I've known put up for some time. But then I should think the man was hard put to it to find any way out of the evidence at all. He did his damnedest, I will say that for him."
"Well, look at it from the other way, and can you think of a reasonable explanation for Lamont's killing Sorrel?"
"Tut, tut, Grant, you've been at the Yard for I don't know how many years, and you're looking at this late stage for reasonable murders? You need a holiday, man. Lamont probably killed Sorrel because the way he ate had got on his nerves. Besides, it isn't any of our business to fit psychology to people, or to provide motives, or anything of the sort. So don't worry your head. Fit them with good watertight evidence and provide them with a cell, and that's all we have to bother about."
There was a short silence, and Grant gathered up his papers, preparatory to taking his leave and getting along to Waterloo.
"Look here," said Barker, out of the silence, "all joshing apart, do you believe the man didn't do it?"
"I don't see how he could not have," Grant said.
"There's the evidence. I can't say why I'm uneasy about the thing, but that doesn't alter the fact that I am."
"Is this an example of the famous flair?" said Barker, with a return to his former manner. But Grant would not be other than serious this morning.
"No,
I think it's just that I have seen Lamont and talked to him when he was telling his story, and you haven't.
That's what I said to begin with,
Barker reminded him.
Lamont has tried a sob story on you and put it over. Put it out of your head, Grant, until you get even a tittle of evidence to substantiate it. Flair is all very well, and I don't deny that you have been uncanny once or twice, but it has always been more or less in accordance with the evidence before, and in this case it most emphatically isn't.
That's the very thing that makes me worry most. Why should I not be pleased with the case as it stands? What is it that makes me not pleased? There is something, but I'm blowed if I can see what it is. I keep feeling that something is wrong somewhere. I want something that will either tighten up the evidence against Lamont or loosen it.
Well, well, said Barker good-humouredly. Go ahead. You've done so well so far that you can afford to play yourself for a few days more. The evidence is good enough for the police court, or any other kind of court for that of it.
So Grant betook himself through the sunny, busy morning to Waterloo, trailing a little cloud of discontent behind him as he went. As he stepped from the warm pavement into the cool vault of the best but saddest of all London stations, the very name of it reeks of endings and partings, gloom sat on his face like a portent. Having obtained the necessary authority to open any luggage that Sorrel might have left, he repaired to the left luggage room, where a highly interested official said,
"Yes, sir, I know them. Left about a fortnight ago, they were,"
and led him to the luggage in question. It consisted of two well-worn trunks, and it occurred to Grant that neither was labelled with the Rotterdam Manhattan Company's labels, as they should have been, if Sorrel had intended going aboard at Southampton. Nor were they addressed at all. On ordinary labels on each was written in Sorrel's writing, A. Sorrel, but nothing else. With his own keys and a slight quickening of heart, he opened them. Below the top garment in the first were Sorrel's passport and tickets for the voyage. Why had he left them there? Why not have taken them with him in a pocketbook? But alongside them were the labels supplied by the company for the labelling of passengers' luggage. Perhaps for some reason Sorrel had meant to open the trunk again before going down on the boat train and had postponed labelling it till then, and had left his tickets and passport there as being safer than a pocketbook in a queue. Grant continued his examination. There was no further indication that Sorrel had not intended to go abroad, as he said. The clothes were packed with a care and neatness that surely argued a further use for them. There was method, too, in the manner of their disposition. The articles which would presumably be needed first were there to hand, and the less necessary ones farther down. It was difficult, looking at the packing, to believe that Sorrel had not intended to take out the articles himself at some future time, and there was no information, no letters, no photographs. That last struck Grant as the only remarkable thing about the luggage, that a man who was going abroad should have no souvenirs of any sort with him. And then he came on them, packed at the bottom, between a pair of shoes, a little bundle of snapshots. Hastily he untied the piece of string that held them together, and looked them through. At least half of them were photographs of Gerald Lamont, either alone or with Sorrel, and the rest were old army groups. The only women in the collection were Mrs. Everett and some VADs who seemed to be incidental to the army groups. Grant almost groaned aloud in his disappointment. He had untied that string with such mighty, if vague, hopes, that when he had tied up the bundle again, he put it in his pocket. VADs might be incidental in a group, but individually they were women, and as such, not to be despised. And that was all. That was all he was going to get from the luggage he had been banking so heavily on. Troubled and disappointed, he began to put the things back as he had found them. As he lifted a coat to fold it, something fell from a pocket and rolled along the floor of the left luggage room. It was a small blue velvet case, such as jewellers use for their wares. No terrier is quicker on a rat than Grant was on that small, slowly revolving box, and no girl's heart beat at the opening of a velvet case as Grant's heart beat at the opening of that one. A press with his thumb, and the lid flew up. On the deep blue lining lay a brooch, such as women wear in their hats. It was made from small pearls in the form of a monogram, and was very simple and rather beautiful. M.R., said Grant aloud. Margaret Ratcliffe. His brain had said it before his thoughts had time to gather round it. He stared at the trinket for a little, took it up from its velvet bed, turned it in his hand, and put it back again. Was this his clue, after all? And did these common enough initials point to the woman who kept stumbling into this case so persistently? It was she who had stood behind Sorrel when he was killed. It was she who had booked a berth on the same day, on the same ship, to the same destination as Sorrel. And now, the only thing of value found among his belongings was a brooch with her initials. He examined it again. It did not look the kind of thing that is sold by the dozen, and the name on the box was not that of a firm usually patronized by impecunious young bookmakers. It was that of a Bond Street firm of good reputation, with wares corresponding in price. He thought that on the whole his best step would be to go and see Messrs. Gallio and Stein. He locked up the trunks, put the brooch in his pocket with the snapshots, and departed from Waterloo. As he mounted the stairs of a bus, he remembered that Lamont had said that the notes he had been given by Sorrel had been wrapped in white paper, such as jewellers use. One more good mark for Lamont. But if Sorrel were going abroad in the company of, or because of, Margaret Ratcliffe, why should he hand over such a sum to Lamont? Mrs. Ratcliffe had money of her own, Simpson had reported, but no man started out to live on the woman he was eloping with, even if he was sorry to leave his friend in comparative poverty. The business of Messrs. Gallio and Stein is conducted in a small and rather dark shop in Old Bond Street, and Grant found but one assistant visible. As soon as Grant opened the blue box, the man recognized the brooch. It was he who had dealt with the customer about it. No, they did not have them in stock. It had been made to order for a Mr. Sorrel, a young fair man. It had cost 30 guineas and had been finished, he consulted a book, on the 6th, a Tuesday, and Mr. Sorrel had called and paid for it and taken it away with him on that date. No, the assistant had never seen the man before. He had described what he wanted and had made no fuss about the price. Grant went away thinking deeply, but no nearer a solution. That a man in Sorrel's position had been willing to pay 30 guineas for an ornament argued infatuation of an extreme type. He had not presented it to the object of his devotion up to the time of his departure. That meant that it could be presented only after he had left Britain. It was packed deep in his trunk. He had no friends in America that anyone knew of, but Margaret Ratcliffe was going out by the same boat. That woman! How she came into things! And her entry, instead of making things clearer, merely made the muddle worse than before. For muddle, Grant was now convinced there was. It was nearly lunchtime, but he went back to the yard because he was expecting a message from the post office. It was there waiting for him. On the morning of the 14th, Wednesday, a telegram had been handed in at Brixton High Street post office, addressed to Albert Sorrel, on board the Queen of Arabia, and reading, "Sorry, Jerry." It had presumably been delivered, since there had been no word to the contrary. But it was not unlikely that in the shoal of telegrams attending the departure of a big liner, if it had not been claimed, it might have been mislaid. "So that's that," said Grant aloud, and Williams, who was in attendance, said, "Yes, sir," accommodatingly. "And now what?" He wanted to see Mrs. Ratcliffe, but he did not know whether she had returned home. If he rang to inquire, she would be forewarned of his renewed interest in her. He would have to send Simpson again. Mrs. Ratcliffe would have to wait for the moment. He would go and see Mrs. Everett instead. He gave Simpson his instructions, and after lunch went down to Fulham. Mrs. Everett opened the door to him, with no sign of fear or embarrassment. Judging from the expression of her eyes, her hostility was too great to permit of her harbouring any other emotion. What line should he take with her? The stern, official one would be useless, both from the point of impressing her and from the point of extracting information. The dead man had done well to call her Lady Macbeth. And a magnanimous overlooking of the part she had played in Lamont's escape would also have no effect. Flattery would earn nothing but her scorn. It occurred to him that the only method of dealing with her to any advantage was to tell her the truth. "Mrs. Everett," he said, when she had led him in, "we have a case that will hang Gerald Lamont, but I'm not satisfied myself with the evidence. So far, I haven't caught Lamont out in a misstatement, and there is just the faintest possibility that his story is true, but no jury will believe it. It is a very thin tale, and told baldly in a court of law would be beyond belief. But I feel that a little more information will tip the scales one way or another. Either prove Lamont's guilt beyond a doubt, or acquit him. So I've come to you. If he's innocent, then the chances are that the extra information will go to prove that, and not his guilt. And so I've come to you for the information." She examined him in silence, trying to read his motive through the camouflage of his words. "I've told you the truth," he said, "and you can take it or leave it. It isn't any softness for Gerald Lamont that has brought me here, I assure you. It's a matter of my own professional pride. If there's any possibility of a mistake, then I've got to worry at the case until I'm sure I've got the right man." "What do you want to know?" she said, and it sounded like a capitulation. At least it was a compromise. "In the first place, what letters habitually came for Sorrel, and where did they come from?"
"He got very few letters altogether. He had not many friends on these terms."
"Did you ever know letters addressed in a woman's hand come for him?"
"Yes, occasionally."
"Where were they posted?"
"In London, I think."
"What was the writing like?"
"Very round and regular and rather large."
"Do you know who the woman was?"
"No."
"How long had the letters been coming for him?"
"Oh, for years. I don't remember how long."
"And in all these years you never found out who his correspondent was?"
"No."
"Did no woman ever come to see him here?"
"No."
"How often did the letters come?"
"Oh, not often. About once in 6 weeks, perhaps, or a little oftener."
"Lamont has said that Sorrel was secretive. Is that so?"
"No, not secretive. But he was jealous. I mean, jealous of the things he liked. When he cared very much about a thing, he would hug it to himself, if you know what I mean."
"Did the arrival of the letters make any difference to him, make him pleased or otherwise?"
"No, he didn't show any feeling that way. He was very quiet, you know."
"Tell me," said Grant, and produced the velvet case. "Have you ever seen that before?" He snapped it open to her gaze.
"M.R.,"
she said slowly, just as Grant had done.
"No, I never saw it before. What has that got to do with Bertie?"
"That was found in the pocket of a coat in Sorrel's trunk." She put her worn hand out for it, looked at it with curiosity, and gave it back to him. "Can you suggest any reason why Sorrel should commit suicide?"
"No, I can't. but I can tell you that about a week before he left to go, left here, a small parcel came by post for him. It was waiting for him when he came home one evening. He came home that night before Jerry, Mr. Lamont.
Do you mean as small a parcel as this?
Not quite, but as big as that would be with wrapping round it.
But the man in Gallio and Steins had said that Sorrel had taken the brooch away with him.
Can you remember what day that was?
I wouldn't swear to it, but I think it was the Thursday before he left.
On Tuesday, Sorrel had taken the little parcel from the jeweller, and on Thursday evening the little parcel had been delivered at Sorrel's rooms. The inference was obvious. The woman had refused his offering.
What was the writing on the parcel like?
It was addressed only on the label, and the address was printed.
Did Sorrel show any emotion on opening it?
I wasn't there when he opened it.
Then afterwards?
No, I don't think so. He was very quiet, but then he was always quiet.
I see. When did Lamont come and tell you what had happened?
On Saturday.
You knew before then that the man in the queue was Sorrel?
No. The description of the man wasn't published in full until Thursday, and I naturally thought that Bert had sailed on Wednesday. I knew that Jerry would have been with him up to the last minute, so I didn't worry. It was only when I saw the description of the man the police wanted that I put the two descriptions together and began to wonder. That was on Saturday.
And what did you think then?
I thought, as I think now, that there was a very bad mistake somewhere.
Will you tell me what Lamont told you? He has made a statement to us already. She hesitated a moment and then said,
Well, I can't see that things can be worse than they are,
and told him the story Lamont had told her. To the smallest detail, it coincided with what he had told Grant and the constable in the train coming south. And you didn't find anything fishy in such a story?
I don't know that I would have believed the story from a stranger.
She was extraordinarily like her niece at that moment, the inspector thought.
But you see, I know Jerry Lamont.
But you knew Sorrel very much longer and didn't know the things that mattered in his life.
Yes, but that was Bertie. Length of time has nothing to do with it. I heard about everything that happened to Jerry, girls included.
Well, thank you for telling me all you did, Grant said as he stood up. If nothing you have said helps Lamont very much, at least it doesn't incriminate him any further. Did you ever have any reason to think that Sorrel wasn't going to America at all?
Do you mean that he was going somewhere else?
No, I mean that if he contemplated suicide, his going to America might have been an elaborate blind.
I certainly don't think that. I'm sure he intended to go to America.
Grant thanked her again and went back to the yard. From Simpson, he learned that Mrs. Ratcliffe and her sister were still at Eastbourne, and there was no word of their return.
Does Mr. Ratcliffe go up and down to Eastbourne, then?
No, Mr. Ratcliffe had been down only once since they were there, and then he didn't stay the night.
Did you find out what the quarrel was about?
No, the maid apparently had not known. From the secret amusement that radiated from Simpson's freckled face, Grant deduced that the interview with the Ratcliffe maid had been more amusing than informative, and he dismissed him dolefully. He would have to go down to Eastbourne and see Mrs. Ratcliffe, accidentally. But tomorrow he would have to attend the Lamont case at the police court. It would be a purely formal occasion, but he would have to be there. There was no time to go down to Eastbourne tonight and get back with any hope of obtaining the casual kind of meeting with Mrs. Ratcliffe that he contemplated. But if the case was over quickly tomorrow, he would go straight down there. He wished duty did not call him to the court. That was routine, and the visit to Mrs. Ratcliffe was not. It was a hunt, a sporting chance, a gamble. He wanted so badly to see what Margaret Ratcliffe's face would look like when he showed her the monogrammed brooch. Chapter 16. Miss Dinmont assists. Gowbridge Police Court is at no time a cheerful building. It has the mouldering atmosphere of a mausoleum, combined with the disinfected and artificial cheerfulness of a hospital, the barrenness of a schoolroom, the stuffiness of a tube, and the ugliness of a meeting house. Grant knew it well, and he never entered it without an unconscious groan, not for the sorrows that hung about it like invisible webs, but for his own sorrow in having to pass a morning in such surroundings. It was on occasions such as a morning in Gowbridge Police Court that he was wont to refer to his profession as a dog's life, and today he was in a bad mood. He found himself looking with a jaundiced eye on the rank and file of the force as represented by those on duty in the court, on the hearty and self-sufficient magistrate, on the loafers on the public benches. Conscious of his nauseated mental condition, he hunted round as usual for the reason with a view of banishing it, and after a little cogitation ran it to earth. He was unhappy about giving his evidence. At the bottom of his heart he wanted to say, "Wait a bit. There's something here that I don't understand. Just wait till I find out a little more." But being a police inspector, with perfectly good evidence and the countenance of his superiors, he could not do that. He could not qualify what he had to say with any remarks of that sort. He glanced across the court to where the lawyer who had Lamont's case was sitting. Lamont would want some bigger guns than that when he came up for his trial at the Old Bailey, or he wouldn't have a dog's chance. That big guns cost money, and lawyers are professional men, not philanthropists. Two cases were summarily dealt with, and then Lamont was brought into court. He looked ill, but was perfectly collected. He even acknowledged the inspector's presence with a slight smile. His arrival created a stir in the public part of the court. There had been no press warning that the case would be dealt with there today, and all those present were either curious idlers or friends of principals in other cases. Grant had looked for Mrs. Everett, but she was not there. Lamont's sole friend in court seemed to be the paid one who had charge of his interests. Nevertheless, Grant looked again now for a sign of personal interest on any face. He had found before now that useful information can be obtained from the expressions of presumed strangers in the body of a court. But a careful scrutiny revealed nothing. Nothing but curiosity was apparent on any countenance in the audience. But as he left the box, after giving his evidence, he saw a newcomer at the back of the court, and the newcomer was Miss Dinmont. Now, Miss Dinmont's holiday did not finish for a week yet, and she had said at that fateful manse tea that since she had holidays only once a year, she spent them all at home. And as he sat down, Inspector Grant was marvelling at the girl, who would not soften towards a man she believed to be guilty of a terrible thing, but who would cut short her holiday and travel 500 miles to hear the evidence for herself. Lamont had his back to her, and it was unlikely, unless he deliberately looked round the room as he went out, that he would be aware of her presence. She caught the inspector's eye upon her, and bowed to him, unperturbed. In her neat, dark tailor-made and small hat, she looked the complete, self-possessed, charming woman of the world. She might have been a writer looking for copy for all the emotion she showed. Even when Lamont was remanded and led out of court, her good-looking face was not stirred. They were very alike, aunt and niece, Grant thought. That was probably why they did not like each other. He went up to her as she was leaving and greeted her. "Are you doing anything, Miss Dinmont? Come and have lunch with me, will you?" "I thought inspectors lived on tablets of condensed beef extract, or something like that, during the day. Do they really have time to sit down to a meal?" "Not only that, but they have a very good one. Come and see." And she smiled and came. He took her to Laurence, and over the meal she was quite frank about her change of plans. "I couldn't stay in Carninish after what happened," she said.
and I had an itch to hear the court proceedings, so I just came. I have never been in a court of law in my life before. It isn't an impressive spectacle."
"Not a police court, perhaps," he admitted, "but wait till you see a big trial."
"I hope I never shall, but it seems that I'm going to. You have a beautiful case, haven't you?"
"That is the word my chief uses about it."
"And don't you agree?" she asked quickly.
"Oh, yes, certainly." To admit to Mrs. Everett that he was not satisfied was one thing, but he was not going to blazon it abroad, and this independent girl was certainly abroad. Presently she mentioned Lamont directly.
"He looks bad," she said judicially, using bad in her professional sense. "Will they look after him in prison?"
"Oh, yes," said Grant. "They take very good care of them."
"Is there any chance of their badgering him? Because I warn you, he won't stand any badgering as he is now. Either he'll be seriously ill, or he'll say that he did it."
"Then you don't believe he did?"
"I think it's unlikely. But I'm quite aware that the fact that I think so doesn't make it so. I just want him to get a fair deal."
Grant remarked on her matter-of-fact acceptance of his word at Carninish as to the man's guilt.
"Well," she said, "you knew much more about it than I did. I never saw him till 3 days previously. I liked him, but that didn't make him guilty or innocent. Besides, I'd rather be a brute than a fool."
Grant considered this unfeminine pronouncement in silence, and she repeated her question. "Oh, no," Grant said, "this isn't America, and in any case he has made his statement as you heard, and he is not likely to change his mind or make another."
"Has he any friends?"
"Only your aunt, Mrs. Everett."
"And who will pay for his defense?"
Grant explained.
"Then he can't have any of the good ones. That doesn't seem to be particularly fair, for the law to keep famous lawyers to do their prosecuting, and not famous lawyers to defend poor criminals."
Grant grinned. "Oh, he'll have a fair deal, don't you worry. It is the police who are harried round in a murder case."
"Did you never in all your experience know a case where the law made a mistake?"
"Yes, several," Grant admitted cheerfully. "But they were all cases of mistaken identity, and that's not in question here."
"No, but there must be cases where the evidence is nothing but a lot of things that have nothing to do with each other, put together until they look like something, like a patchwork bed cover."
She was getting too hot to be comfortable in her search after enlightenment, and Grant reassured her and unostentatiously changed the subject, and presently fell silent. A sudden idea had occurred to him. If he went down to Eastbourne alone, Mrs. Ratcliffe, however casual his appearance, might be suspicious of his bona fides. But if he appeared with a woman companion, he would be accepted at once as off-duty, and any suspicion his presence might arouse would be lulled until he could get Mrs. Ratcliffe completely off her guard. And the whole success of the expedition depended on that— that she should be unprepared for any demonstration on his part. "Look here," he said, "are you doing anything this afternoon?"
"No, why?"
"Have you done your good deed for the day?"
"No, I think I've been entirely selfish today."
"Well, get it off your chest by coming down to Eastbourne with me this afternoon, as my cousin, and being my cousin till dinner, will you?" She considered him gravely.
"I don't think so. Are you on the track of some other unhappy person?"
"Not exactly. I'm on the track of something, I think."
"I don't think so," she said slowly. "If it were just fun, I'd do it like a shot. But when it means something I don't know, for someone I've never met, you see?"
"I say, I can't tell you about it, but if I give you my word that you'll never regret it, will you believe me and come?"
"But why should I believe you?" she said sweetly.
The inspector was rather staggered. He had commended her lack of faith in Lamont, but her logical application of it to himself disconcerted him.
"I don't know why," he admitted.
I suppose police officers are just as capable of fibbing as anyone.
And considerably more unscrupulous than most, she added dryly.
Well, it's just a matter for your own decision, then. You won't regret coming, I'll swear to that, if you like, and police officers are not given to perjury, however unscrupulous they may be. She laughed.
That got you, didn't it? She said delightedly, and after a pause, Yes, I'll come and be your cousin with pleasure. None of my cousins are half as good-looking.
But the mockery in her tone was too apparent for Grant to find much pleasure in the compliment. They went down through the green countryside to the sea, however, in perfect amity, and when Grant looked up suddenly and saw the downs, he was surprised. There they stood in possession of the landscape, like someone who has tiptoed into a room unheard and startles the occupant by appearing in the middle of the floor. He had never known a journey to the south coast pass so quickly. They were alone in the compartment, and he proceeded to give her her bearings. I am staying down at Eastbourne. No, I can't be. I'm not dressed for the part. We've both come down for the afternoon, then. I am going to get into conversation with two women who know me already in my professional capacity. When the talk turns on hat brooches, I want you to produce this from your bag and say that you have just bought it for your sister. Your name, by the way, is Eleanor Raymond, and your sister's is Mary. That is all. Just leave the brooch lying round until I arrange my tie. That will be the signal that I have had all I want.
All right. What is your first name, by the way?
Alan.
All right, Alan. I nearly forgot to ask you that. It would have been a joke if I had not known my cousin's name. It's a queer world, isn't it? Look at those primroses in the sun, and think of all the people in terrible trouble this minute.
No, don't. That way madness lies. Think of the pleasantly deserted beach we're going to see in a few minutes.
Do you ever go to the Old Vic? She asked,
and they were still telling each other how wonderful Miss Bayliss was when they ran into the station, and Grant said, Come on, Eleanor, and grabbing her by the arm, picked her from the carriage like a small boy impatient to try a spade on the sands. The beach, as Grant had prophesied, was in that pleasantly deserted condition that makes the South Coast resorts so attractive out of the season. It was sunny and very warm, and a few groups lay about on the shingle, basking in the sun in an aristocratic isolation unknown to summer visitors. "We'll go along the front and come back along the beach," Grant said. "They are bound to be out on a day like this."
"Heaven send they aren't on the downs," she said. "I don't mind walking, but it would take till tomorrow to quarter these."
"I think the downs are ruled out. The lady I am interested in isn't much of a walker, I should say."
"What is her name?"
"No, I won't tell you that until I introduce you. You are supposed not to have heard of her, and it will be better if you really haven't." They walked in silence along the trim front towards Hollywell. Everything was trim, with that well-ordered trimness that is so typically Eastbourne. Even the sea was trim and slightly exclusive, and Beachy Head had the air of having been set down there as a good finish-off to the front, and of being perfectly conscious of the fact. They had not been walking for more than 10 minutes when Grant said, "We'll go down to the beach now. I'm almost certain we passed the couple I want some time ago. They are down on the shingle." They left the pavement and began a slow, foot-slipping stroll back to the piers again. Presently, they approached two women who were reclining in deck chairs facing the sea. One, the slighter one, was curled up with her back to Miss Dinmont and the inspector, and was apparently reading. The other was snowed round with magazines, writing pad, sunshade, and all the other recognized paraphernalia of an afternoon on the beach, but she was doing nothing and appeared to be half asleep. As they came abreast of the chairs, the inspector let his glance fall casually on them and then stopped. "Why, Mrs. Ratcliffe," he said.
Are you down here recuperating? What glorious weather! Mrs. Ratcliffe, after one startled glance, welcomed him.
You remember my sister, Miss Lethbridge?
Grant shook hands and said, I don't think you know my cousin, but the gods were good to Grant that day. Before he could commit himself, Miss Lethbridge said in her pleasant drawl,
Good heavens, if it isn't Dandy Dinmont, how are you, my dear woman?
Do you know each other, then? Asked Grant, feeling like a man who has opened his eyes to find that one more step would have taken him over a precipice.
Rather, said Miss Lethbridge. I had my appendicitis in a room at St. Michael's, and Dandy Dinmont held my head and my hand alternately, and she held them very well, I will say that for her. Shake hands with Miss Dinmont, Meg. My sister, Mrs. Ratcliffe. Who'd have thought you had cousins in the force?
I suppose you are recuperating too, Inspector, Mrs. Ratcliffe said.
You could call it that, I suppose, the Inspector said. My cousin is on holiday from Mike's, and I have finished my case, so we are making a day of it.
Well, it isn't tea time yet, said Miss Lethbridge. Sit down and talk to us for a little. I haven't seen Dandy for ages.
You'll be glad to have that awful case off your hands, Inspector, her sister said, as they subsided on the shingle.
She spoke as though the murder had been just as much of an event in Grant's life as it had been in hers. But the Inspector let it pass, and presently the talk veered away from the murder and went via health, restaurants, hotels, and food to dress, or the lack of it.
"I love your hat brooch," said Miss Dinmont idly to her friend. "I can think of nothing but hat brooches this afternoon, because we've just been buying one for a mutual cousin who's getting married. You know, like getting a new coat and seeing people's coats as you never saw them before. I have it here somewhere."
She reached for her bag without altering her reclining position and rummaged in it until she produced the blue velvet box.
"What do you think of it?"
She opened it and extended it to them.
"Oh, lovely," said Miss Lethbridge,
but Mrs. Ratcliffe said nothing for a little.
"M.R.," she said at last. "Why, the initials are the same as mine. What is your cousin's name?" "Mary Raymond." "Sounds like a goody-goody heroine out of a book," remarked Miss Lethbridge. "Is she goody?" "No, not particularly, though she's marrying an awful stodge." "You like it, then?"
"Rather," said Miss Lethbridge.
"Beautiful," said her sister. "May I have a look at it?"
She took the case in her hands, examined the brooch back and front, and handed it back.
"Beautiful," she said again, "and most uncommon. Can you get them ready-made, so to speak?"
Grant's infinitesimal shake of the head answered Miss Dinmont's cry for help.
"No, we had it made," she said. "Well, she's a lucky devil, Mary Raymond, and if she doesn't like it, she has very poor taste."
"Oh, if she doesn't like it," said Grant, "she can just fib and say she does, and we'll never be a bit the wiser. All women are expert fibbers."
"Hark at him," said Miss Lethbridge. "Poor disillusioned creature."
"Well, isn't it true? Your social life is one long series of fibs. You are very sorry you are not at home, you would have come, but you wish someone would stay longer. If you aren't fibbing to your friends, you are fibbing to your maids."
"I may fib to my friends," said Mrs. Ratcliffe, "but I most certainly do not fib to my maids."
"Don't you?" said Grant, turning idly to look at her. No one to see him there, with his hat tilted over his eyes and his body lounging, would have said that Inspector Grant was on duty.
"You were going to the United States the day after the murder, weren't you?"
She nodded calmly.
"Well, why did you tell your maid that you were going to Yorkshire?"
Mrs. Ratcliffe made a movement to sit erect and then sank back again.
"I don't know what you're talking about. I most certainly never told my maid I was going to Yorkshire. I said New York."
That was so patently possible that Grant hastened to get in first with, "Well, she thinks you said Yorkshire," before Mrs. Ratcliffe inevitably said, "How do you know?" "There isn't anything a police inspector doesn't know," he said.
"There isn't anything he won't do, you mean," she said angrily. "Have you been walking out with Annie? I shouldn't be surprised if you suspected me of having done the murder myself."
"I shouldn't wonder," said Grant. "Inspectors suspect all the world."
"Well, I suppose I can only give thanks that your suspicions led to nothing worse than walking out with my maid."
Grant caught Miss Dinmont's eyes on him under the short brim of her hat, and there was a new expression in them. The conversation had given away the fact that Mrs. Ratcliffe had some connection with the Kew murder, and Miss Dinmont was being given furiously to think. Grant smiled reassuringly at her.
"They don't think I'm nice to know," he said. "But at least you can stick up for me. Justice is the thing I live for."
Surely she must see, if she thought about it, that his inquiries in this direction could not be very incriminating to Lamont. The chances must be the other way about.
"Let's go and have tea," Miss Lethbridge said. "Come along to our hotel, or shall we go somewhere else, Meg? I'm sick of anchovy sandwiches and currant cake."
Grant suggested a tea shop which had a reputation for cakes, and began to bundle Mrs. Ratcliffe's scattered belongings together. As he did so, he let the writing pad drop so that it fell open on the sand, the first sheet exhibiting a half-written letter. Staring up at him in the bright sunlight were the round, large letters of Mrs. Ratcliffe's script.
"Sorry,"
he said, and restored the block to the pile of papers and magazines. Tea as a gastronomic function might have been a success, but as a social occasion, Grant felt that it failed miserably. Two out of his three companions regarded him with a distrust of which he could not fail to be conscious, and the third, Miss Lethbridge, was so cheerfully determined to pretend that she was not aware of her sister's ill-humour that she tacitly confessed her own awareness of tension. When they had taken leave of each other, and Grant and his companion were on their way to the station in the fading light, he said, "You've been a brick, Miss Dinmont. I'll never forget it." But she did not answer. She was so quiet on the way home that his already discontented thoughts were further distracted. Why couldn't the girl trust him? Did she think him an ogre to make such unscrupulous use of her as she suspected? And all the time his looker-on half was smiling sardonically and saying, "You, a police inspector, asking for trust? Why, Machiavelli was fastidious compared with a CID man." When Grant was at war with himself, his mouth had a slight twist in it, and tonight the twist was very marked. He had found not one definite answer to the problems that troubled him. He did not know whether Mrs. Ratcliffe had recognized the brooch or not. He did not know whether she had said New York to her maid or not. And though he had seen her writing, that helped to no conclusion. A large percentage of women wrote large and very round hands. Her pause at sight of the brooch might have been merely the pause while she read the twined initial. Her veiled questions as to its origin might have been entirely innocent. On the other hand, they most emphatically might not. If she had anything to do with the murder, it must be recognized that she was clever and not likely to give herself away. She had already fooled him once when he dismissed her so lightly from his mind on the first day of the investigations. There was nothing to prevent her from going on fooling him unless he found a damning fact that could not be explained away. "What do you think of Mrs. Ratcliffe?" he asked Miss Dinmont. They were alone in the compartment, except for a country yokel and his girl.
"Why?" she asked. "Is this merely making conversation, or is it more investigation?"
"I say, Miss Dinmont, are you sore with me?"
"I don't think that is the correct expression for what I feel," she said. "It isn't often I feel a fool, but I do tonight."
And he was dismayed at the bitterness in her voice.
"But there's not the slightest need," he said, genuinely distressed.
You did the job like a professional, and there was nothing in it to make you feel like that. I'm up against something I don't understand, and I wanted you to help me. That's all. That's why I asked you about Mrs. Ratcliffe just now. I want a woman's opinion to help me, an unbiased woman's opinion.
Well, if you want my candid opinion, I think the woman is a fool.
Oh, you don't think she's clever, deep down?
I don't think she has a deep down.
You think she's just shallow? But surely, he considered.
Well, you asked me what I thought, and I've told you. I think she's a shallow fool.
And her sister? Grant asked, though that had nothing to do with the investigations.
Oh, she is different. She has any amount of brain and personality, though you mightn't think so.
Would you say that Mrs. Ratcliffe would commit a murder?
No, certainly not.
Why not?
Because she hasn't got the guts, said Miss Dinmont elegantly. She might do the thing in a fit of temper, but all the world would know it the next minute, and ever afterwards as long as she lived.
Do you think she might know about one and keep the knowledge to herself?
You mean the knowledge of who was guilty?
Yes. Miss Dinmont sat looking searchingly at the inspector's impassive face. The lights of station lamps moved slowly over and past it as the train slid to a halt.
"Erridge! Erridge!"
called the porter, clumping down the deserted platform. The unexpectant voice had died into the distance, and the train had gathered itself into motion again before she spoke.
"I wish I could read what you are thinking," she said desperately. "Am I being your fool for the second time in one day?"
"Miss Dinmont, believe me, so far I have never known you do a foolish thing, and I'm willing to take a large bet I never shall."
"That might do for Mrs. Ratcliffe," she said. "But I'll tell you, I think she might keep quiet about a murder, but there would have to be a reason that mattered to herself overwhelmingly. That's all."
He was not sure whether the last two words meant that that was all that she could tell him, or whether it was an indication that pumping was to cease, but she had given him food for thought, and he was quiet until they ran into Victoria.
"Where are you living?" he asked. "Not at the hospital?" "No, I'm staying at my club in Cavendish Square."
He accompanied her there against her wish, and said good night on the doorstep, since she would not be persuaded to dine with him. "You have some days of holiday yet," he said, with kindly intention. "How are you doing to fill them in?"
"In the first place, I'm going to see my aunt. I have come to the conclusion that the evils one knows are less dreadful than the evils one doesn't know."
But the inspector caught the glint of the hall light on her teeth, and went away feeling less a martyr to injustice than he had for some hours past. Chapter 17 Solution. Grant was disconsolate. His radiance was dimmed as the yard had never known it dimmed. He even snapped at the faithful Williams, and only the surprised hurt on that bland pink face recalled him to himself for a little. Mrs. Field blamed it unconditionally on the Scots, their food, their ways, their climate, and their country, and said dramatically to her husband, after the manner of a childish arithmetic,
"If 4 days in a country like that makes him like this, what would a month do?"
That was on the occasion when she was exhibiting to her better half the torn and muddy tweeds that Grant had brought back with him from his foray in the hills. But she made no secret of her beliefs and her prejudices, and Grant suffered her as mildly as his worried soul would permit. Back in the everyday routine and clearing up arrears of work, he would stop and ask himself, what had he left undone? What possible avenue of exploration had he left untravelled? He tried deliberately to stop himself from further questing, to accept the general theory that the police case was too good to be other than true, to subscribe to Barker's opinion that he had nerves and needed a holiday. But it was no use. The feeling that there was something wrong somewhere always flowed back the minute he stopped bullying himself. If anything, the conviction grew as the slow, unproductive, tedious days passed, and he would go back in his mind to that first day, little more than a fortnight ago, when he had viewed an unknown body and